How would you like to attend a conference and hear Matt Harrison, Craig Parton, Jonathan Fisk, Will Wheaton, Chris Roseborough, and Al Schmidt? You're invited to the 2014 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 13th and 14th in Collinsville, Illinois. Registration is $100 per person. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 13th and 14th in Collinsville, Illinois. issuesetc.org.
The modern left has grown tired of debate. Their new strategy is simply to try to silence their critics.
When the local evangelical pastor gets up and ends his prayer with a reference to Jesus' sacrificial death on the cross, that moment in the parade of pluralism is offensive.
Sin essentially is high treason against the king, against the sovereign.
Your sins are forgiven. Though you're a rotten, damned sinner of the law, Jesus came for such sinners. Jesus loves sinners. Jesus comes only for sinners. Jesus dwells in sinners. Jesus is for you. You're forgiven.
I'm Daniel Berquist. I'm from Lincoln, Nebraska, and I'm a Macintosh software engineer. And I love Issues Etc.
These are crimes for which, well, in a lot of cases, we haven't written any laws yet. We try and fit them into other existing laws, but crimes that have been committed by individuals, it doesn't matter where they are in the world. They could be here. They could be across the globe. The crimes are committed not in the streets, but, well, they used to call it, remember how quaint it sounds? The information superhighway, right? The internet. Now, I'm not talking about having your identity stolen, although that could be part of this. Secrets stolen, secrets accessed, stolen, made known, made public. In the world of the internet, 20 years ago, no one even imagined this could happen. Well, maybe they did, but apparently they didn't imagine it at this scale. There's even a name for this now. Hacker, we all know what that means. Someone who kind of accesses something he shouldn't access. He doesn't have permission to access on the internet, and activism put together, mashed together into hacktivism. What are the ethical considerations when we think about this crime, this, well, I don't even know what to call it, because sometimes, like I said, laws haven't even been written to apply to it yet. We're going to be talking about hacker activism. Dr. Doug Grodheis of Denver Seminary will be our guest for the first half hour. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. A little bit later, we'll talk dating with Pastor Sam Schultheis, author of an article for Higher Things magazine titled A Nerdy Lutheran's Guide to Dating. Our call-in number for the next hour, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, or a tweet at issuesetc. Dr. Doug Grodheis is a regular guest. He's professor of philosophy at Denver Seminary, author of numerous books, including The Soul in Cyberspace and Christian Apologetics. And he's also written an article for the Christian Research Journal titled Hacktivism, Heroes or Villains, A Christian Assessment of Hacktivism. Doug, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Pastor. It's good to be here.
You say that this activity, this crime that we're going to call hacktivism, needs to be placed in a larger historical and theological context as we begin to discuss it. What is that context?
We need to look at it in terms of a biblical theology and biblical ethics. So the way I deal with it in the article is to consider the whole phenomena of secrets. Why do we have secrets? Keep them? Why do we try to expose secrets? And when you think about it, the only reason that humans would have for secrets is that something moral is wrong with the world that has affected human beings and made them dishonest. That is the entry of sin into the world. If everyone were perfectly loving and just, there would be no reason to keep any secrets. So I think we need to view it in that capacity, that secrets, human secrets, are a result of the fall, and so we have to handle them very carefully. They're very delicate things to assess. So you have creation, which emphasizes truth, truth-telling, being true to the truth, and you have the fall, where our first parents want to hide from God. They want to hide themselves from the divine audience. And then you have the excuses that are given. Why sin entered the world. It wasn't Adam's fault. It was his wife's fault. It was the serpent's fault, and so on. So they're trying to hide the truth, and they're trying to hide themselves from God. So we need to consider those elements, and then we need to consider another agency that stems from the fall, and that is the civil government or the state. The state in the Bible has essentially a negative role to punish evildoers or to protect the innocent from those who would perpetrate crimes. So to protect the innocent and to punish the guilty, and of course to write and enforce laws. And Paul says in Romans 13 that the state has the power of the sword. The way of putting that is the power of legitimate violence. That is, the state can conscript people for war. The state, through the police, may arrest people. The state may declare war on the nation's enemies and so on. So the way this relates to hacktivism is we know that secrets are something that flow or stem from the fall. We realize that they're a part of our world and a necessary part now. You consider the significance of secrets in warfare, camouflage, for example, or encoding messages, trying to decode messages from an enemy. And we have things like lights that go on in a house when you're not there, which is trying to deceive a potential robber, and so on. So we have to say some secrets are legitimate. Obviously, some secrets to cover up sin are not legitimate. And then we ask, does the state have the right to keep some secrets? And the answer has to be yes. The state doesn't publicize its battle plans in a war. It doesn't reveal everything about its whereabouts. For example, we all know sometimes police cars will hide a bit in a busy thoroughfare. And we may not like that, but we realize that's really what they need to do if they want to catch people who are speeding. But, of course, if they're in plain sight, people may slow down faster. So when I look at hacktivism, I try to put it in those three categories, creation, fall, and then what is the role of the state on a biblical viewpoint.
Okay, let's talk about I'm looking at people like, you know, now I say the name Snowden and people know exactly who I'm talking about. A face pops into the mind because although he committed many of the crimes of which he is accused, ironically, in secret, we now know who he is. He's even granted an interview, a rather public interview recently with NBC News, if I'm not mistaken. I'm trying to get into this guy's head, not to his motivations, but to his head. And I wonder what you think about this, Dr. Grotheis. Is there kind of a, could there be kind of a utopian view here? A guy who says, look, all secrets are lies. Lies are bad, especially when told by governments. And therefore, there are no legitimate secrets. Everything should be open and known. Now, in order to hold that viewpoint, at least from my limited perspective here, you'd have to kind of have a utopian view that all this is better out in the open. What are your thoughts?
Right. I didn't see that interview, but certainly a secret is only a lie when someone tells a lie to cover it up. There may be many things that are not known that no one is asking about. So if secrets and lies are not the same thing, logically. But some of the hacktivists have a kind of anarchistic approach to civil government. That is, the government keeps lies, keeps secrets, rather, and often tells lies to cover them up. And the answer to that kind of intrusion into public life is to expose what the civil government is doing. Now, that is very naive, because in an age of terrorism and even homegrown terrorism, some surveillance is necessary in a preemptive sense. That is, what would a terrorist do? Who would he contact ahead of time? The state needs to know that. And some surveillance is necessary for finding and prosecuting terrorists. Now, if you deny that, then you're really taking away the security of the nation. But at the same time, because leaders in the civil government are sinners and they are simply finite and they don't know what the right thing to do is all the time, they will sometimes abuse that power. They will overreach. So to think that we simply make everything public and that will answer or that will solve the problem and give us all the answers we need is utopian, because some information needs to be hidden so evildoers will not use that information. If you have a submarine out in the ocean, you don't advertise where it is if you're using the submarine for surveillance, because the enemy could find it or another country could monitor it in ways that would not be advantageous, let's say, to the United States. So again, the question of secrecy, is not an entirely simple one. It's not as simple as saying all secrets are bad. Now, if it were an unfallen world of perfect love and righteousness, then openness would be fine. Good grief, our first parents didn't even need clothes, right? But in a way, this idea that you just open everything up to the public and have no secrets is, in a sense, the internet equivalent of nudism, that we can simply go naked because we have nothing to hide and everything's wonderful. Well, it's a fallen world. We need clothes and we need secrets.
Dr. Doug Grotheis is our guest. We're talking about hacker activism, also known as hacktivism, on this Tuesday afternoon, May the 27th. If you have a question or a comment, we are coming to you live. Our call in number 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Send us an email right here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org, or a tweet at issuesetc. When we come back, why are some hacktivists regarded as heroes? We'll answer that question after this.
That first presentation will be on how lawyers look at making the case for the reliability of the New Testament.
Craig Parton talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
The information we have about Jesus, primarily about his life and death and resurrection, primarily comes from the four Gospels, certainly from the rest of the New Testament. But if the record we have of Jesus Christ can't be relied on, we're doomed.
You can meet and hear Craig Parton making the case for the historical Jesus June 13th and 14th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, just look for the Making the Case logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case conference, June 13th and 14th in Collinsville, Illinois.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the Issues Etc. Journal logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
Here's a special offer for Issues Etc. listeners. For any size gift during the Easter season, we'll send you a CD of an Easter sermon and a sermon on the prophet Job preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check, Issues Etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. And for any size gift between Easter Sunday and Ascension Day, we'll send you a CD of two of Todd's sermons.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin on this Tuesday afternoon, May the 27th. We're talking about hacker activism. Dr. Doug Grotheis of Denver Seminary is our guest. Dr. Grotheis, we were talking before about kind of trying to take apart some of the motivations behind the hacker activism. What about the American public? I'm kind of asking you to put a fair amount of the American public on the analyst couch, so to speak. Why are the what is the impulse to regard hacker activists? At least our initial impulse is to kind of cheer them on as heroes, maybe dark heroes, but heroes nonetheless. What's behind that?
I think part of it is that people feel under the thumb of the civil government, of the state, and they're concerned about their privacy. They're concerned about legitimate secrets, and they don't want their domain to be violated. But at the same time, you have to keep in mind larger concerns, such as national security and so on, or the legitimate secrets that businesses have over their competitors. We just found recently that China was hacking into some American businesses, not even the civil government. They were hacking into these businesses to try to steal business secrets that would make their businesses more profitable. So when you're talking about hacktivism, you have to ask, well, who's doing it? And maybe the Chinese case is not hacktivism per se, but it is a kind of hacking. So it may not always be easy to distinguish what is just hacking proper, going where you're not authorized to go, maybe just for your own purposes, and hacktivism, which at least on the surface is for the common good. And I think Americans have this weakness for the idea of a hero or a superhero or the individual or the group that subverts the system, that turns everything on its head. You know, the David versus Goliath kind of idea. But you have to go deeper than that. Sure, individuals have stood up to civil power with groups. You think of Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. But we're dealing with a whole new world here. And as Christians, we have to ask whether or not instances of hacktivism are actually theft. Because biblically, it's a moral absolute that you should not steal. You should not take another person's property without authorization or without permission. That's theft. So if we can categorize and classify an instance of hacktivism as theft, and there's no element of self-defense there or any kind of wartime consideration, then obviously it has to be considered morally wrong and against the will and against the character of God.
How would you respond to someone who says, well, while their methods may be unconventional, they're essentially doing in a far more efficient way what journalism intends to do? Journalists, are, while they have sets of ethics that guide them, certainly would love to get their hands on some of the secrets that have been uncovered through hacktivism. What's the difference between the two?
Well, they're both under the same moral law of God, and journalists consider what kinds of information they should and should not have. And, of course, some of them end up being tried and prosecuted for stealing secrets or not revealing their sources. And I think some of these hacktivists, in a sense, are political journalists because they publish, right? They don't publish in a newspaper or a magazine or a journal. They may not be on a regular television program. However, they make the information known. So WikiLeaks in 2010 published on their website secrets of the American military operation in Afghanistan. Why? They think that what is being done there, or much of what is being done there, is unjust. But you have to also consider the lives and the welfare of American soldiers. And that sort of wanton disregard for America's interests, or thinking that America somehow is so wrong that the secrets of its military have to be exposed, is very unconvincing.
What about those who say what we're dealing with here is classic civil disobedience, a resistance movement, even if it's one guy behind his computer screen?
Right. Well, it could be legitimate civil disobedience if the situation is extremely oppressive to the citizens, if the civil government is betraying its own constitution, and if it's the last resort. But I don't think we're in that kind of a situation. And the danger is that these hacktivists become vigilantes about this kind of thing. In fact, in the article, I point out a group called Anonymous that tries cases itself and then prosecutes people they think are guilty. So I give an example of a rape trial where two football players were accused of raping a 16-year-old girl. They were not convicted, but this group, Anonymous, claimed that they were guilty. So what they did was expose secrets and expose a lot of information about these football players, in a sense trying to punish them because the courts did not punish them. Now, I am very critical of something like that because how does this group know more than the judge and the jury? That's very presumptuous to assume that. And it's also unjust because we have a system of justice. Obviously, it's not perfect. Obviously, it makes mistakes. But it is a settled system of rules and evidence. And why should this group of hacktivists think that they know far better than what is decided by the court, such that they can try the case themselves and condemn or convict the two suspects and then punish them by revealing information about them?
Someone says, look, turnabout is fair play. We've discovered in the last 5 years or so that, just to speak in the American context, our government knows far more about us than we ever wanted it to know. That the NSA has been listening in, watching where we thought we had a presumption of privacy. And turnabout is fair play, Dr. Grothaus. Your response?
Well, the simple response is two wrongs don't make a right. So we have to consider the extent of the surveillance, whether or not this is violating our civil liberties, and then what the right course of action would be. I am very concerned about developments in surveillance through technologies such as drones, such as miniature robots that can fly into a room, photograph, and record things. They're really daunting when you think about the possibility of these being used by the wrong people. But at the same time, there are other ways to challenge these things through legitimate or normal forms of social action, perhaps protest marches, letters to congressmen, senators, writing articles about this, electing the right people, and so on. So I don't think we're at the point where individuals or groups should simply say, we are in a completely totalitarian society, let's say that of 1984, therefore turnabout is the fair play, therefore we will hack into their systems and promote the common good by exposing them. I'm very reluctant to say we're at that point, and that, in fact, could make things worse.
There are people who do presently live under genuinely totalitarian systems.
Right.
Where normal recourse to justice is simply an impossibility for them. Not to play situation ethics, which I'm sure you wouldn't, what would be the can we talk about a principled hacktivism for people who find themselves with absolutely no recourse, but they do have an internet connection?
Well, certainly. I think that oppressive governments who try to control speech and to censor the internet should be opposed because they have no right to restrain and to muzzle their citizens like that. So when I hear about, let's say, citizens in Ukraine or citizens in China using the internet to get the word out and perhaps even hacking into systems to expose what are very, you know, very dangerous political situations, I'm a lot less reluctant to condemn them because they're in a situation that is much more difficult and much more extreme. Now, with China, you have a totalitarian government, certainly. The situation in Ukraine, which I'm not an expert on, but I know that people involved with the internet are trying to speak the truth to power with respect to Russian domination and so on. So I guess my basic answer is I'm not a relativist, I'm not a situation ethicist, but you have to ask what the situation is, whether or not it warrants civil disobedience, because you have to always consider the situational perspective. So what might be morally wrong here, given that we still have a lot of freedoms, might be morally correct somewhere else because they do not have those freedoms and because the civil government is going against what God has called it to be. So you have the same principles of what civil government should be, what citizenship should be, the wrongness of theft, the wrongness of oppressing citizens, but those principles will apply somewhat differently given the context.
Well, and for the Christian, if I could add my two cents here, for the Christian, Christianity is no stranger to civil disobedience in its
right.
long history. I think the Christian principle always is either to say, look, this is morally necessary. It may not be permissible, but it may be morally necessary. And I fully expect if caught to suffer the civil consequences for this kind of disobedience. What are your thoughts there?
Right. Well, that was certainly Martin Luther King's strategy because the civil rights movement did break standing law and King went to jail and he wrote his famous letter from a Birmingham jail. And he was criticized for breaking the law, and he said, I broke man's law, but I didn't break God's law. But he was willing to be punished for what he did. That's very different than what you find in hacktivism. The idea is to find secrets, expose secrets, and then keep secret. That's very different.
So how do we come out on this generally? How would you summarize how a Christian ought to understand hacktivism, see it for what it is, kind of call the thing what it is, and to the best of our ability, ethically respond to it? How would you summarize it, Dr. Grotheis?
I would try to keep it in a theological perspective that I laid out earlier, that secrets can be good or evil in a fallen world. The state has legitimate authority from God, but the state can overreach. The state can become a beast, the beast of Revelation 13. I also say that we're kind of in the early stages of thinking about this ethically. And my article was really more of a shot across the bow than any kind of systematic assessment of the ethics of hacktivism. I'm looking for moral philosophers and theologians and others to make some sense out of this and give us some insights. And also realize that each case is different, really. If someone is a hacktivist in China, he may have very different motives and very different goals than a hacktivist in the United States. So I'd say let's proceed biblically, logically, try to see what the facts on the ground are, ask for discernment, and not rush to judgment. My article is a little bit tentative in parts because this whole situation is not entirely clear to me. The biblical principles, I think, are clear, but then how they apply to given situations may require more thinking and more experience. So I'm looking forward to people who take this up, write on it, and really think it through.
Dr. Doug Grotheis is professor of philosophy at Denver Seminary. He has authored numerous books, including The Soul in Cyberspace and Christian Apologetics. He's also written an article for the Christian Research Journal titled Hacktivism, Heroes or Villains? Doug, thank you very much, and both you and your wife are always in our prayers.
Thank you very much, Pastor. I always enjoy being on the show.
When we come back, we're going to spend a little time talking with Pastor Sam Schultheis. Dating, oh my goodness. Well, it is maybe something that parents say no to, absolutely. You can when you're 18. And then the pressures come right around the age of 15. There's always the fearful prospect for the father. It usually falls to the father, but often maybe by default to the mother, of having that conversation with your child before they begin dating. How should we understand it? What kind of examples shall we find in even pop culture to say, look, dating is primarily friendship. It's not a prelude to marriage. But then again, we get some bad advice, don't we? People saying, well, you should date around as often as you can. Play the field before you settle down. How do we respond to that kind of advice on dating? When we come back, we'll answer some of those questions with Pastor Sam Schultheis. He's pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Huntington Beach, California, and he'll be our guest right after this.
No matter the size, big or small, RP Lumber can deliver it all. From pickups to one tons to box trucks and booms. Everywhere you look, you see blue. RP Blue. RP prides itself in customer service. RP will deliver quality products to your home, business, or job site. And you can be sure of timely delivery on clean trucks with courteous drivers. So when you think of service, think blue. RP Blue. With over 50 local community locations, for 37 years, RP Lumber.
Have you wondered what classical Lutheran education is all about? Are you a Lutheran homeschooler, pastor, or teacher? Would you like to be equipped to teach more effectively? Join the Consortium for Classical and Lutheran Education July 15th through the 17th at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Find the conference schedule recently posted at ccle.org. Discover the education that is our Lutheran heritage, ccle.org.
Folks attending last year's Making the Case Conference absolutely loved the barbecue from Randy's House of Barbecue in Troy and Highland, Illinois. The pork, chicken, ribs, and beef are prepared just like the old days in a pit cooked over hickory, apple, and wild cherry wood. Randy's House of Barbecue, Route 40 and Troy O'Fallon Road in Troy, and at 2649 Northtown Way in Highland. Randy's House of Barbecue, randysbbq.com.
Do you wish your Lutheran school offered Latin, Greek, or logic? What about German or calculus? Right now, local Lutheran schools in two different states are utilizing Wittenberg Academy to expand their course offerings. Whether it's Latin for third graders or logic for seniors in high school, Wittenberg Academy can help. For your homeschooler or for your brick-and-mortar Lutheran school, we have solutions. To find out more, visit wittenbergacademy.org.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
In Hosea 4, we read, "My people are destroyed by lack of knowledge." At the CLCC, we educate Lutherans on being Lutheran. The Confessional Lutherans for Christ's Commission treasure our Lutheran beliefs and think that all Christians would if they learned what we believe, teach, and confess. Visit our website at theclcc.org. See what we have to offer. Get on our mailing list, or better yet, join us. And encourage your pastors to hold an event in your area. For more information, go to theclcc.org.
What happens when our theology is driven by freshness instead of faithfulness? I've written an article for the latest Issues Etc. journal titled New Thing Theology. You can read it by subscribing to the online Issues Etc. journal. Just look for the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. The Wittenberg Trail feature details how Bob Leko journeyed from the Word Faith movement to faith in Christ alone. The free online Issues Etc. journal.